Good afternoon. This is a podcast runs through it. I'm Nelson King, here with my co-host Dixie Hart. And this afternoon we're going to be interviewing Melissa Romano, who is running for Superintendent of Public Instruction. That's the Office of Public Instruction, which I would reckon a lot of you may have heard about, but don't know much about. And we're hoping by the time we're done with this interview, we'll have a much better idea of another one of the very important statewide public offices, which generally don't get enough attention. It's a kind of cold, windy, semi-snowy day here, and we're appreciative for Melissa to come in and have a discussion with us, primarily on education topics, but we'll see. Good afternoon. I think that's important maybe to just start out with her introducing herself and maybe telling us a little about what is the Superintendent of Public Instruction? What do they do? Why are they important? Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Great. Well, thank you. It's great to be here. So I guess first and foremost, I am a wife. I am a mother. I am a Montanan. I am also a proud product of Montana's public schools, and I am not a career politician. I am, in fact, an experienced and an accomplished educator. I have been in the classroom for over 16 years, and I believe it's possible to create a system where fewer students fall through the cracks, a system where every student receives the best preparation possible to then go on and live a fulfilling and a productive life. I am running for this position because it is an important one, like you said, and I do agree with you that there are sometimes people who don't quite understand what the state superintendent does. I get lots of questions sometimes about, can you change my child's textbook? We don't like that. And that's really not what the state superintendent does. In my opinion, the state superintendent has the ability and the opportunity to really create a vision for Montana's schools and districts, and then provide or allocate resources and supports to the districts to benefit all children, so all children will be successful. The state superintendent, in my opinion, should be a partner with the Montana School Board of Public Ed, and I definitely plan to do that. I think that in this position, just like I tell the students in my classroom, collaboration is key to success. And as state superintendent, that would be something I'm very interested in, is collaborating with all stakeholders of education to the benefit of kids, because really this is a race about kids and how can we help all kids in our state be successful.
I think people don't always, they worry a bit about, well, the state's going to tell us exactly what to do and our boards won't be free and independent, and that's not how it works.
Correct.
And I think what you've been saying is that the Superintendent of Public Instruction is really there to lead, set some guidelines.
Absolutely.
Help.
Yep.
Which means money, usually.
Yep.
That sort of thing. Is that relatively accurate?
Absolutely. And, I'm running for this position because I believe that it is time to restore competent, focused leadership at the Office of Public Instruction. You know, when you look back at what our current superintendent has done or not done in terms of the legislature and either supporting or opposing bills for our students, she hasn't supported bills that would further education in Montana for students, and she hasn't opposed bad bills. For example, when you look at just this last session, House Bill 303, which called to end compulsory education as we know it, almost completely dismantling public education, she was nowhere to be found. She simply didn't show up. When, there were bills that called to enhance mental health supports in schools, That would be tremendous for our schools. You know, we know we have a mental health crisis happening in our schools. We know we have a really high suicide rate. In my opinion, the state superintendent needs to be taking the charge and be a leader and show up at the legislature and help educate what's going on in our schools. She simply wasn't there. The same was true with a bill regarding career and technical education that would have expanded opportunities for our students in the field of career and technical education. And again, she simply wasn't anywhere to be found and didn't support that bill either. You know, Ms. Arnson talks a lot about putting students first. And in my opinion, and especially as a classroom educator, watching the lack of leadership at the Office of Public Instruction, that isn't putting students first. It's putting them dead last. And we need a superintendent in that position who truly will show up for students each and every day and work to ensure that all students have the resources they need to learn. I am running to be a strong advocate for all students, from our four-year-olds to our 21-year-olds, especially at the legislature and when it comes to funding our public schools. I'm running for this position because I firmly believe that Montanans need a state superintendent who understands the day-to-day challenges that our school districts face. I have been, it's been a privilege to be in the classroom as an educator, and I feel like I do understand those challenges, and I look forward to bringing the same passion that I have for my classroom into the Office of Public Instruction.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's correct that the public instructor, the superintendent of public instruction, runs a scale from pre-K all the way up to post-grad, right? I mean, in less so perhaps on the ends of it, you deal mostly with elementary and
it's secondary. Mostly K-12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think your mandate is the entire scope of education, right, in some respects, which is, well, these days it's kind of, people are finally beginning to understand that education begins very early and never ends, really.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, you adult education might be part of your venue.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, Montana is still one of just a handful of states that does not offer public preschool experiences for our four-year-olds. And I really see that is a great opportunity for our state to be able to reach students and provide them for success in the future. We know that all the research says that when we intervene early and we prepare students to be ready to then go on to kindergarten, that we are not only helping them that year, but we're helping them the next year and the year after that, all the way up until graduation, ensuring that there is a more likelihood that they're going to graduate on time. And so that's something that I'm going to be fighting really hard for, is to figure out how can we provide public preschool in this state for our four-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I want to mention is, you know, your motivation and why you do this. Is it elected or chosen? I can't remember how they work that, but you were Teacher of the Year in 2018, and
yeah,
That's pretty signal honor. You don't do that without having done a lot of hard work and putting a lot of energy and personal belief into that. What is your feeling about education? How did you get into it? I mean,
that's a great question. So I did not start out as a young adult thinking I was going to be an educator. I was actually really interested in art and photography. And so my first degree was actually a photography degree. And upon getting that, I realized it was going to be a little challenging for me to make a living. And I found myself on the East Coast as a nanny. And it was during that experience as a nanny and working with children that I absolutely fell in love with teaching. There is just something about being able to see and witness a child learning something for the first time that is just amazing and life-changing. And that happened for me when I was a nanny, and I knew then that that's what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, and went back to school, did sort of a non-traditional entry into school. So I was still being a nanny during the day, and then I went back to school at night and moved back to Montana upon getting my degree, and was very fortunate to get a job in Helena right away. And again, the same things I saw as a nanny, I then got to witness in my first classroom and see second graders at that time. It was my first job. See second graders learning to read and, you know, learning how to add double-digit numbers that I got to be a part of. And it was just that feeling of being able to make a difference in a child's life is amazing, and it's the best job in the world, in my opinion.
I believe I know you've taught quite a few different things, but math is one of your primary interests.
Yeah.
Would you classify yourself as a STEM teacher? Let me just explain. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. And these days people feel that needs to be emphasized, particularly for young girls, but for everybody. Mm-hmm. And how do you classify? I mean, how do you sit with that particular identification?
Yeah. So I, that's an interesting question. I think I would actually classify myself as a STREAM teacher. So that would be science, technology, reading, engineering, arts, and mathematics. In terms of education, sort of my philosophy is, approaching it as a problem solver. I want my students to be able to be creative thinkers and problem solvers. And for me, that means presenting them unique situations and challenges, problems per se, that they use a variety of skills to tackle. So, during math time, it's not necessarily where students are just sitting down and completing a worksheet of math problems, but rather we've identified a problem, maybe it's even a community problem that needs to be solved, and students are incorporating many skills to solve that problem. So they're incorporating reading skills and technology and arts and math into one problem to solve. And so I tackle it much more as an integrated approach, which so I like to call it STREAM instead of STEM, because I do think that the arts are incredibly important. I know just in my own life, I have 4 children, and 2 of them are extremely into art and, just love being able to express themselves through art, drawing and ceramics, photography. And I've seen how important that is for them in their own education. And it's something that in my own classroom, I would always try to present opportunities for students to express themselves in artistic ways as well. And so I don't want the arts to be forgotten about.
That kind of leads into questions of curriculum. Mm-hmm. To what degree does the superintendent of public instruction get involved with curriculum?
That's a great question. There's oftentimes people think that the superintendent can just, quickly change some curriculum, and that's not exactly how it works. We have the Office of Public Instruction sets a calendar for when standards are reviewed and revised. As an educator, I've sat on several different revision committees where teachers from across Montana get together, we look at the standards, we talk about what's working, what's not working, what would need to be changed. When former Superintendent Denise Juno was in the state, she was great about bringing together groups of educators to talk about curriculum and to talk about what was working. And not only would she bring together educators, but she would bring together students as well, which I think is a hugely important thing, is to have student voice and representation, especially when we're talking about curriculum. Curriculum is an interesting thing, knowing that the jobs that we're preparing our students for right now, many of those jobs don't exist. And so I think it's important that we continue to have a revision process at the Office of Public Instruction for how to review standards, how to revise them, because education is changing. What we want our students to know today isn't necessarily going to be what they need to know 10 years from now. So the superintendent definitely has a place or a role in the standards revision process, but the superintendent shouldn't be the one simply saying, here's what the standards are going to be. We need to have a very comprehensive voice from people all across Montana when it comes to what we want our students to know and learn.
Mm-hmm. Setting curriculum is a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. It's also sometimes controversial, of course.
It can be, yes.
And it's also related to money. I know that one of the issues we deal with here is the amount of money available for, let's say, the arts.
Mm-hmm.
or physical education for that matter. In a number of districts, they've been dropping off pieces of the curriculum because they don't feel like they have enough money to do it. What role does the superintendent play in any of that? Where you have a kind of blend of issues revolving around money and administration and so forth, and curriculum and content.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. You know, I do think the superintendent needs to set a vision for our schools and our students about what does it mean to be a Montana graduate? When you graduate from a Montana high school, you know, what are you leaving with? The superintendent can definitely help shape that. As far as, you know, specific programs that are happening in various schools across our state, you know, that's often a local control issue, which is one of the most wonderful things about our state. You know, there's just no way that I could sit here and say what happens in Helena is, and, you know, the programs that are offered in Helena is going to be what the kids in Ekalaka or Forsyth, Montana need. You know, it's one of the beautiful things about Montana is that we have local control and local school boards able to make decisions about what's best for their communities. As state superintendent, I would continue to support local control and help provide, you know, supports and resources to local school boards that may be needing support or have certain questions about programs that would be best for their communities.
Well, moving for a little bit from what you teach to how you teach it, the education field is probably, ask any teacher and you'll find a different way of teaching, right? I mean, good.
Yes.
But in a certain sense, you also, I know teachers talk about this all the time, is how to teach. Mm-hmm. And there are many different ways of approaching that. Do you have any particular slant on that? Or?
Yeah, I absolutely do. So early on in my career, I was fortunate to be trained in sort of a philosophy or a way of teaching, which was called cognitively guided instruction for algebraic thinking. And so it was centered around mathematics. And specifically at that time, I was trained in how to get second graders, that was my first class, how to get them to really talk about mathematics, but more specifically about algebra. While that was interesting and I enjoyed that training, it really helped shape my entire philosophy of education, because that entire training was about, as a teacher, not being the one to constantly stand up and just deliver information, but be able to be a listener and actually listen to students and gather the information from students as they're talking to then drive students to do their best and push them as far as they could go. And that's a philosophy I've taken forward into everything I teach. I think it's critically important for me to be more of a listener than the talker. In my classroom, I feel like if I'm doing a good job, I'm the person that's talking the least, and my students are the ones that are talking the most. And that can be really challenging for some teachers, right? There are some teachers who really like a quiet classroom and everything needs to be orderly, and that just simply isn't the way I ever taught. It's not how I'm comfortable. I really want to be the one listening to my students and, you know, circulating all over the classroom and hearing what they're saying and watching to see what they're doing, so that then gives me what my next steps are. I do believe, you know, I've always in my classroom, I've always had a hands-on approach to learning. And, you know, in my latest class as a fourth grade teacher, you know, there wasn't a day that went by that, you know, we weren't using some sort of physical manipulative in the area of mathematics, because I really wanted my students to develop a concept concretely first by being able to explore things and manipulate things before then going into some sort of algorithm for them to, you know, memorize how to do long division. You know, we explored that concept by using manipulatives long before we would ever been doing, excuse me, paper pencil things. And so that's sort of just my personal philosophy. But I've worked with all kinds of teachers, and that's the beauty of education, is that, you know, we don't always do it the same. Most of us, you know, I can say all of the teachers I've worked with, the goal is always the same, is that we want our students to learn. We care about them deeply. This is definitely a profession of the heart. You know, I haven't met a teacher in Montana ever who didn't care immensely about their students and does want the absolute best for them. How we present our material and curriculum is very different. And I think that, you know, that's the amazing thing about teaching. And all of our students are different. You know, no, there's no two students that are the same. And so I think being able to have different teachers and different teaching styles is really important.
And the kids know. I mean, they
know.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
They talk, yep. You know, that, well, that teacher's really strict, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they pick up on the differences between teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Part of your approach, at least, is that you want to deal with each student,
mm-hmm.
and try to help each student receive what they need and reach their potential.
Mm-hmm.
But that's affected by class size.
Yes.
And class size is a money issue.
Yes, it is.
I imagine that shows up in the superintendent's office, that, you know, you obviously don't set the budgets and you don't set class sizes, but mm-hmm. that's got to be an issue for you.
Yeah. You know, I'll speak to it sort of two different ways. I can speak to you as a classroom educator and tell you that, you know, class size is important. And, you know, when you have a smaller class size, you are able to, you know, really have that student-centered classroom where you're able to reach the students simply because there's less of them in the room. And I have heard often that there's not a lot of research that supports class size, that smaller class sizes are better. But I know my own personal experience that class size does matter. And then on the other end, as somebody who's running for office, I think class size is still important, and I do think that it matters. And as a, you know, as a candidate and somebody who be possibly looking at policy, for me, it really comes back to funding and the importance of having a strong advocate at the Office of Public Instruction to show up at the legislature and talk about the importance of why it's important to have well-funded public schools. You know, I believe that that is the best opportunity we have to send every child in this state off to a bright and successful future. It's well-funded public schools, and you know, that goes back to the class size. If we don't have well-funded schools, you know, students' class sizes tend to be bigger. So it is an issue.
That kind of leads to one of the hot buttons, which is the private versus public education. Now, you would be superintendent of public instruction.
Mm-hmm.
In an environment where there are things like charter schools, which blend, sometimes they're public, sometimes they're private, and then there are private schools, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's a complicated mix these days, and unfortunately politically charged frequently. How do you feel about that? I mean, how do you see the superintendent's role in dealing with, obviously you have no direct connection to the private schools, but they're part of the mix. They're there.
Yeah.
And charter schools, for that matter. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I will say that I believe public funds should go to public schools, and I don't think public funds should be going to private or religious schools. I think that that takes taxpayer money away from the kids who need it the most. I do think that there is a space and a place, maybe, for increased partnerships with our homeschool communities and, you know, our private school communities. I think that when we look at our kids in Montana, you know, like we want our kids to be successful. I just happen to believe that public funds should go to public schools. It doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean I think that private schools should go away or charter schools should go away. I think that those are options for people, and that there are many families who want to make that choice, and that's a great choice for them. However, public money should go to public schools.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned homeschooling. I know that that's a growing element. I don't know what percentage now of the total number of students, but it's quite a few, particularly in this state. You know, homeschooling is becoming more organized. How do you feel about that particular aspect of education? Again, it's not your domain if you're superintendent of public instruction,
mm-hmm.
but it's there.
It is. You're absolutely right. It is there. And again, you know, for me, this is a race. At the end of the day, it's about kids. For this race, public school kids, right? I'll say it again. I do think that there are times where partnerships and collaboration is necessary. And there have been instances in our state where districts have partnered with homeschool communities for the betterment of school kids. So one example I'm thinking of was in Helena, and I don't know for sure if it's still happening. I'd have to double check. But at one point in time, their homeschool students would attend one of our local museums and receive some science classes at that museum. And that was a partnership that happened with the school district and the homeschool community. And it was a great partnership. You know, the students got to receive some great science lessons and content from a certified science teacher, and had a great time doing it. So from my perspective, you know, this position, like I said before, this is about collaboration. And I don't think it's about closing doors and just saying, no, I'm not willing to, you know, partner. I think partnerships are absolutely critical. And that's something that I'm looking forward to doing in this position.
Yeah, our local House representative, Lori Bishop, is really passionate about early childhood education. And I know that she's worked really hard on legislation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. You know, Lori's great. I appreciate and value her work that she's done on early childhood education. You know, as a candidate, as somebody who's hoping to be the next state superintendent of public instruction, early education is important to me. I taught kindergarten for only 1 year, and then moved on to a different grade level. But I had the opportunity to see firsthand what it was like when a student entered my kindergarten classroom and wasn't ready to learn. You know, people often don't realize that we have kindergarten students coming to school that have never held a pencil, have never held scissors, don't know how to do those things. And, you know, as a kindergarten teacher, when you're trying to just teach those things, those students aren't necessarily ready to learn content. You know, you have to backtrack and really teach some pretty basic skills. I believe that public preschool experiences would help immensely in being able to teach some of those skills and helping to have our students prepared to enter kindergarten, ready to learn. And so as a state superintendent, I will be fighting hard for funding for our earliest learners. I think that in our state, you know, we say that we're the treasure state, but in my mind, you know, the real treasure of our state is our students, and it is worth investing in our young learners and making sure that we figure out a way in this state to provide public preschool. So I appreciate Lori's work.
And do you think public opinion is pretty much in favor of early childhood education? Is the problem more with the legislature?
You know, I'd like to say that yes, public opinion is in favor of that. Obviously, in my circles, it is. So I would like to say that yes, it is. And I'd like to just remind folks that, you know, we didn't always have full-day kindergarten here in this state. And, you know, in the legislature, that took multiple sessions before full-day kindergarten happened. And I think that the same thing is going to happen with public preschool. I think it's, you know, it's time. We've had some go-arounds in the past. I think that, you know, we are starting to move the needle with some legislators. And I think it's going to happen. And I look forward to fighting for that.
Let's shift a little bit to what's going on in our schools, issues that you have to deal with. One of the ones that's come to the surface in Montana is the suicide rate. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that's a very complicated, serious problem and serious issue. It's not just the school's issue, but it's in the schools, mm-hmm. whether it's public, private, or otherwise.
Yep.
What's your take on that? I mean, how do you feel, not only how you feel about it, but what can schools do? As a superintendent, how do you feel about that?
So, you know, it's one of my top three priorities, social, emotional learning, social, emotional health. We have an extremely high suicide rate. It's something that I am really looking forward to working with all stakeholders on to figure out how can we work on decreasing the suicide rate. You know, it's interesting. I'm just getting off of 2 days at the State Educator Conference that was in Belgrade, and I actually presented on social emotional learning and the real need for teachers to deliberately be teaching social emotional learning. I would be naive to sit here and say, you know, if all teachers just taught social emotional learning lessons, that we would decrease the suicide rate. So please don't get that message. But I do think that it's one step. It's one part of the puzzle. You know, when we as teachers and educators and school communities and even, you know, larger communities are able to help our young students, our young people be able to, you know, identify their emotions and build self-awareness and self-management and make responsible decisions. That's all social emotional learning and tied into, you know, our health and well-being of our young people. And so I do think taking a look at, you know, what is Montana doing for social emotional learning? Can we increase or make more rigorous standards in social emotional learning and be more deliberate as a system? You know, can we, again, are there partnerships that we should be working on and creating so that we decrease the suicide rate? Because it is an issue. You know, interestingly enough, I think it was in Bozeman recently, I was at an event and I was talking to some high school students, and they were talking about a climate survey that they had taken, and that they, as students, really wanted to be able to identify on their survey as, you know, being a part of the LGBT community. And we know that, you know, in the LGBT community with our youth, they have a high suicide rate. And so it was interesting. It got me thinking about, you know, maybe that is a small step that we can add to that climate survey and start talking to students and amplifying their voice and bringing awareness to that.
Yeah, you opened a box there. Some people would say is Pandora's box. Climate change, LGBTQ. Parents, the role of schools versus the role of the parent. And you're talking about emotional education. Well, the schools can do some of that, but of course, traditionally, people expect the parents to do that. Moral education, which is obviously brings in religion. It's a complicated mix.
It is a complicated mix.
And I suspect that superintendent of public instruction would be, how shall I say it? Not in the middle of that, but trying to in some way structure it, or I don't know. Well, you tell me how you would approach it, given the...
You tell me if I'm not understanding you correctly, but, you know, I really think it comes back to that creating a vision. And I do see that as part of my vision in reaching all children, that, you know, we are in a spot in education where we have to be thinking more holistically, that, you know, when we're preparing students to be productive citizens and to go on and live a fulfilling life, you know, that reaches beyond just, you know, reading, math, science, you know, the core subjects we think about. It reaches beyond that, and I do see that falling into social emotional learning and helping our students be creative thinkers and problem solvers, and, you know, how do you make responsible decisions? I think it starts way, you know, way back in kindergarten, and, you know, getting kids to identify, you know, wow, I saw somebody walking down the street, they had a pinched face and they were checking their watch, maybe that means they're impatient, you know, being able to help students identify that, that's all social emotional learning. And so I do think that the superintendent has a role in creating that vision, and then providing help and resources or allocating that for districts that are wanting it.
Now that there is I won't call it a divide, but there's this approach to education where you're educating people so they can go out and get a job. Vocational, almost, in its approach.
Sure.
And the other is how to go out and live and be a functional human being in this society, a citizen. I won't call that a divide in education because you have to do both. But how do you approach that? What's your feelings about that? given that perspective of, you know, yeah. Well, we train kids to go get a job. No, we train kids to go out and live, you know.
I guess, you know, from my experience, I would say maybe there's less of a divide now. When I've talked with employers and people looking to hire young people, you know, yet those skills are important, that, you know, the reading, the math, the core subjects that we talked about, those are important. But employers are also looking for young people who are innovative and who can think creatively and come up with multiple solutions to a problem. And so, you know, one of the things I've heard some people call those things soft skills. But, you know, I just don't think that they're soft skills. I think that they're hugely important. And to me, they're as important as those other subject areas. I see them more, I guess I don't know that I would say it's a divide. I feel like that they're more intertwined than divided.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
I'm just bringing these things up because I know the
field
of education is complicated.
I love talking about it, great.
Good. Are there any other aspects of our schools besides, I suppose, the obvious one is, do we give them enough money, and what's the physical plant like? I mean, are we actually rebuilding our schools, and are we taking care of the next generation of students and so forth? Issues that you want to talk about or that we haven't really covered.
You brought up a good point about teacher pay. I told you I was just at the educator conference. I actually heard that often from various teachers that stopped by to see me. You know, they want to know, you know, are you going to be fighting for educator salary? And I say, absolutely, yes. You know, that's part of well-funded public schools, being able to pay our teachers a decent professional salary. I know so many educators who teach during the day, and then they still have a part-time job so they can make ends meet. And we need to stop that. We need to figure out, how do we pay our educators a professional wage for the important work that they do each and every day? I would like to say that another issue that's really important in our state right now is teacher recruitment and retention. We know that there are districts all across the state, not just in our rural or eastern Montana spots, but everywhere, where we are not able to fill the positions that we have. And, you know, if we want our students to go on and be successful, it's important that they have a qualified teacher at the front of the classroom. So I will be working hard to sit down with anybody and everybody to start figuring out real viable solutions to how do we recruit teachers for our state, and then how do we retain them. Earlier I talked about social emotional learning for kids, but I do see that social emotional learning and awareness of that is important for teachers as well. You know, this profession, it really is a work of the heart. I've never had a year when I've been with my students where I don't take their stories home with me, you know, who they are as little people and the things that bother them. You know, I take that home with me because it bothers me too. It's hard to see your students suffer. You care deeply about them. And because it's a work of the heart, social emotional learning for teachers is also really important. And I do see that it's a connection with retaining and recruiting teachers. If we have a system in place where teachers feel valued as professionals, where they have the resources they need to give their students, that's huge. But we also need to make sure that we are creating a system and helping teachers have a balance with their work and life outside of work.
Yeah, now while we're talking about teachers, unfortunately, I think, but there's a trend in this country, particularly, to politicize teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the current superintendent has a very strong opinion about that. I think she ran particularly on the idea that the teachers' unions and the teachers in general were too politicized, and they were not teaching what they should be teaching, and that sort of approach. And it puts teachers in a very difficult position, because teaching's hard. You have to throw your heart into it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you're an individual. You have political ideas. You belong to things, as you may have religious ideas and belong to various churches or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's a piece that I suppose the superintendent has to deal with. I don't imagine you legislate on that, but it's part of what you do. What's your approach to it? She's thinking.
I am thinking. It's a great question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how to answer it right here at the moment. Are you thinking of anything specific?
Well, it all ties into when I grew up, which was a while ago. Teachers were highly respected.
Mm-hmm.
And the profession of teacher was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally had people come through my life who were, went to school to teach.
Mm-hmm.
They had special schools for teaching.
Mm-hmm.
They were teachers from beginning to end, sometimes 30, 40-year career teachers. And inside the community, a teacher was pretty much as respected as, let's say, the minister or a religious person of some kind. So that's changed. That's not the way it is in most places in this country right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we keep saying that the kids are our most important responsibility. Yay, rah, rah. But mm-hmm. we don't want to fund teachers,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. I think that that's interesting, just thinking even on my own childhood and, seeing my favorite teacher was Mrs. Mulvaney, but seeing her outside of school at the grocery store and just almost being frozen with fear, like, oh, should I even go up to her? Because I idolized her so much. And I think the way our society is now with just access to information and social media, I think that there's a real opportunity for educators and schools and districts to partner with families and communities. And I'm not sure we're there yet. I think that you're right in what you say about that, it's not that way anymore where teachers are respected, as you talk about in the past. And I've talked with teachers who feel that as well. And I think that things in society have just changed so quickly where, parents have access to information quicker than they ever had it before. And while that has some definite challenges to it, I see it as a real opportunity for education to come together and sort of bridge the gap. And I think that there's definitely work there that can happen in creating a larger community and going back to trying to get back to that teacher as the trusted and respected professional that they are. I agree with you, but I do think we have work to do. And I think that it is about continuing to educate ourselves, educate the profession about, how do we reach parents now? What is the best way to reach parents? What do parents want? I think what parents want now may be different than what they wanted 20, 30 years ago. Our knowledge about standards, I'm sure that, don't quote me on this, and my mother might think differently, but I think that if I asked my mom, Mom, were you aware of what standards were or what I was supposed to be learning when I was in third or fourth grade, she would probably say, no, I had no idea. I just sent you to school and you came back and I just, trusted that your teachers were doing what they should do. And now there's just a sort of this influx of information where the public and our communities and our parents just have so much more access to, what should kids know and what are they supposed to know or what should they do? It's all available on the internet. And I think that that's great. I think that, I'm not saying that that is not great. I think that that's absolutely great. It helps me in my conversations with parents. But I think that it's created an opportunity that we haven't quite utilized yet. Like, how do we hone that in? How do we use that to our advantage so that, we truly are partners helping students?
Yeah, you're talking about a changing culture, changing society.
Yeah, that takes time.
30 years ago, it was parent PTA, parent teachers, right?
Yeah.
Then it became parent teacher students.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'd argue it's parent teacher students and technology.
Yeah.
Specifically the internet.
Yeah.
But just mobile phones and everything else is also, these things show up in the classroom.
Yes.
All
absolutely.
The time.
They're in my house constantly, mm-hmm. as well.
And while education formally maybe doesn't deal with some of this, maybe it should. It should be part of the conversation. How do you feel about technology in the classroom and in general, education, period?
Yeah, you know, I think just like a book, I think technology is a resource and we need to be utilizing it. I don't think that it should replace teachers. I don't think that, you know, it should be the only resource in a classroom. I think it's one resource. And I've seen many, many teachers do incredible things with technology, whether it's being able to connect kids in one classroom to another classroom across the state, across the world. I think that that's great. I think that that's a way to build in empathy with our students. Being able to provide opportunities for students to make connections with other individuals is hugely important. I've seen great lessons to deliver content using technology. You know, I've gotten my own fourth graders to be able to keyboard, you know, using technology. But again, it's about having a balance, and it can't be the end all be all. But it's a huge opportunity that I know that I was certainly thankful for when I was in the classroom.
Pushing it one step further, there's a lot of controversy here. Building controversy about letting machines, computers, teach the kids. Computer-based training, there's a whole bunch of names for this. I'll throw in the word artificial intelligence because that's going to be part of this conversation if it isn't already. Mm-hmm. And the undertow of that is that some way computers and artificial intelligence and that kind of thing is going to be able to do what teachers do. And obviously that's controversial.
Yep.
And but a lot of people are interested, probably confused. What do you think? I mean,
yeah, so, you know, that's an interesting concept. I place a huge emphasis on relationships and the ability for students to build relationships. And if a computer is providing lessons or taking the place of a class or a lesson, that's a missed opportunity. A student isn't able to build a relationship with a computer, right? It kind of goes back to the social emotional learning that we had talked about. I think that, you know, that is a huge skill, a huge part of education that we really want to be helping our students with. But we also know that computers have a place, especially here in Montana, when we know that kids need and use and utilize the Digital Academy for classes. It's, you know, the Digital Academy has been a great resource for students who might need a class that isn't offered in their high school, and they can log online and take that class. So, you know, it's a balance for sure. But for me, relationships are important. And I do think that when our students go out into the world, being able to communicate and empathize and just get along with other people will be important for them.
And you believe that that's part of an educator's job, right?
To deal with some of that. I think great educators do it all the time. You know, I don't think it was interesting when I did this presentation. You know, most educators don't go to school and say, "Oh, today I'm going to teach about, you know, responsible decision making." You know, they set it up in the confines of their classroom, and so they say, you know, well, today I'm going to do this a math lesson, and I really want my students to be able to work in groups, and I want them to be able to collaborate, and I know there's going to be some difficulties, and so you know, one of the things I'm going to do as an educator is I'm going to give them a poster project to do to show what they know about math. I'm going to give each one a different color, and I'm going to set this up so that each color is represented on the poster, so they're going to have to work together. But really, in the back of the mind, I'm also thinking, yeah, this is because I want them to build relationships. I want them to problem solve and work with each other in addition to knowing what they know about math. And great teachers do that seamlessly. So the short answer to your question is yes.
Yeah.
Okay, as a superintendent of public instruction, of course, you would also be holding a position on the state land board. How important is that to you?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, that it's very important to me. So what people might not know about me is that I am an avid hiker and camper and spend as much time as I can outside and especially on our public lands. I have four kids and my husband as well. And so for a family of six, our public lands provide us our vacation areas, provides us spots to make memories. And when I think about that state land board position, I think about making responsible decisions and always protecting Montanans' rights to hunt, fish, and recreate on our public lands. I have loved making memories with my family on those lands, and I want those lands to be around for my kids and their kids and future generations. And so that the land board seat is important. I want to make sure that we're maximizing revenue for schools, but also making reasonable and responsible decisions.
Great.
Any other aspect of teaching or that we're kind of wandering away from what a superintendent of public instruction would do.
That's okay.
On the other hand, it's what informs you in that job. I mean,
absolutely,
you're expected to deal with all these countercurrents and so forth. And education right now is not cut and dried by any means. Not that it ever was, but it's more complicated now than it's probably been, maybe in history.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that a superintendent has to kind of weave through that somehow, especially if you intend to lead.
Yes. But
any comments or thoughts about that job and how you would approach it to finish up here?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I will say that I will approach that job with the same zest and passion that I have for my classroom and my students. I think that it will be an incredible opportunity. I look forward to creating a vision for Montana students, working hard to be an advocate for all students so that they can be successful and go on to live fulfilling and productive lives.
Sounds good. Melissa, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
And for those of you who have been listening in, I hope you'll understand that when we talk about these statewide offices, which the Superintendent of Public Instruction is, these are important. And the candidates deserve your ear and your thoughts. So thank you very
much. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. We had a really interesting interview with Melissa Romano, who is running for Superintendent of Public Instruction. We want to emphasize these state-level offices. I've said it before, and Dixie and I will say it again, that these state-level offices are extremely important. The last time this office was up for election in 2016, there was, let's say a drop-off from the votes given to other offices, and particularly the obvious ones like senator and so forth, and the votes that were cast for this particular office, meaning a lot of people didn't know what this was, didn't know what superintendent of public instruction does, and they didn't vote in that particular category. That has to change, and one of the reasons we're doing this is to push that along so people understand. Any other thoughts, Dixie, about...
Yeah, I was just really, really impressed with her passion, and just she seems to have a very interesting and sort of an integrated approach. She also seems to be very pro-collaboration.
Yeah.
I think that's something that's really needed right now in that office.
Yes, yeah, so in a position that can be pointed to as being way too politicized or way too something or another, the ability to work with other people, regardless of where they're coming from, is an important quality. And she seems to have that.
Right. You know? And I also appreciate her position with the what she was saying about the land board.
Oh, it means something to her.
Yeah.
She you know, it's not from a superintendent's point of view, you might think of it as a bag on the side. But she doesn't think about it that way. It's important to her. And so when you're looking at candidates for the office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, remember they're part of the land board, and that's part of their mandate. So it's a big deal.
It's a very big deal.
So it was an interesting session, lots of questions. I think we could have talked to her for several hours, but I want to stress again, we pay a lot of lip service to our kids, how great they are and how important they are and they're our future, etc. But when you sit down with people like Melissa and you talk about the nuts and bolts of how you get the kids educated and how well they need to be educated, it turns into something else, and it requires time and thought and a little attention. And that's what we're trying to do with these interviews. And we're really grateful to all the candidates who come in and give us time. We record here in Sound Color Studios in Livingston, and many of these people have to travel to get here. And they do this because they want to get not only their personal points out, but because they believe in the offices they're running for. And we really kind of owe them the time to do it right and get them to explain what they mean and what issues they feel. And
Right. And if you, you know, if you feel that education is important, and then this is one race that you definitely want to stay informed about.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody, for listening. That was A Podcast Runs Through It.